Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So a first difficulty, justitia, or justice. In order to appreciate tomorrow the difficulty of attributing mercy to the act of creation, it's important to understand how Aquinas first solves a difficulty with attributing justice to the act of creation. According to Aquinas, there are two broad kinds of justice, commutative and distributive. This is not surprising. These are traditional distinctions that pretty much everybody holds. Commutative bears upon the relation of persons one to another as either individuals, in which case it is particular justice, or to the commonweal, that is, political body, in which case it is legal justice. Questions of punishment fall under this form of justice. Since punishment addresses wrongs done by one person upon another, or a person upon the common good of the political community. Distributive justice bears upon the distribution of common goods to particular individuals, proportionate to some measure of what is due to those individuals. With that distinction in mind, we can turn to what Aquinas says about how divine justice is expressed in creation. The question he pursues in the first part of the Summa Theologiae, question 21. In Article 1 of that question, Aquinas had attributed distributive justice to God, insofar as God acts to provide for his creatures what is due to them according to the measure of their natures. So the proportion described in the general description of distributive justice is here found vis-a-vis God and creatures according to the measure of a creature's nature, human versus leonine versus equine, for example. Aquinas wrote, hence Dionysius says, it's necessary to see that God is truly just, that he gives to each and every existing thing what is proper to it, according to its standing, and preserves the nature of each with proper order and power. Notice two things, however. First, questions of divine justice in punishment do not arise here, because punishment pertains to commutative justice, not distributive justice. And more directly pertinent is that this distributive justice to creatures does not pertain to the immediate effect of being created. Since the distribution of goods to a creature presupposes that the creature already exists, to have goods distributed to it. In particular, the distribution of goods proportioned to creatures is according to the measure of their natures, and so presupposes that those natures already exist. But if those creatures do not already exist with their existing natures, nothing can be due to them, according to the measure of their natures. So if creation involves the granting of existence to a creature, and neither the creature nor the creature's nature exists prior to creation, this existence as an effect is not due to a creature. But then it seems that the act of creation does not manifest God's justice, because it is not due to the creature as measured by the creature's nature. Now, I grew up in the 1970s within a decade of Vatican II, which, of course, I accept and I applaud and love. This is not a comment about Vatican II. It's a comment about after Vatican II. And when I was growing up in the 1970s, a certain kind of liberal strain of theology would kind of say in a very, you know, excited and misty way, it's all gift. Gift, it's all gift, because of course it's not due. It's not a matter of justice, it's gift. So I heard gift about creation probably from 1969 through 19, when did John Paul II become Pope? 78. So that would be one way of understanding, and of course I'm not going to say that creation's not a gift, but the emphasis on not being justice is part of the issue. Aquinas addresses this problem straightforwardly. While it's true that being created is not due to a creature as a debt, he asserts that the character of justice consists in an agent acting according to a due order and proportion to achieve an end. It seems that Aquinas puts the character of justice this way because justice bears upon acts that achieve an end, but as a virtue according to the due order and proportion of the mean, if you remember what Aristotle says about virtue being the mean. That is, the very notion of virtue is of proportion and order in one's acts and passions. Justice also acts to bring about order and proportion between people, that's commutative justice, and order and proportion of the common good to individuals, distributive justice. Moreover, because all things are ordered in proportion to God as end, ordered by God's goodness and wisdom, all God's acts involving creatures must be just. So the end in this case, the case of creation that God acts toward, is not creation itself, as if apart from God, but creation as ordered to God as its end. So when God creates, he creates something, a cosmos, you, whatever it is, as having as its end God himself. Okay? And that's the order, and that's the wisdom. So it is precisely by creation that all created things are directed, ordered, and proportioned by God's wisdom and goodness to God as end. Thus, the element of what is due is preserved not with respect to the creature that is created, but with respect to God himself as creator. Aquinas thus argues that creation is primarily an act of justice of God to himself, not an act of justice primarily directed to the creature, but the creation of the creature is an act of God directed to himself. God is being just to himself by creating you. He says, "For it is due or appropriate to God that he should implement in things that which expresses his will and wisdom, and that manifests his goodness, and according to this, God's justice regards what is fitting to him, insofar as he renders to himself what is due to himself." End of quotation. Thus, creation does manifest God's justice. However, the effect of justice in creation is not God's justice to the creature created, but his justice to himself. In the Summa Contra Gentiles, Aquinas says that this cannot be justice in its proper sense, because the proper sense requires some debt of necessity. Again, the aspect of a debt of necessity is found in the idea of what is due. But we've seen that the notion of what is due has no application in creation, because there's nothing that is owed a debt in creation, as prior to creation, nothing exists except God himself. So, if justice is to be found in any sense in the act of creation, it can only be justice of God to himself as the only thing that exists prior to creation. So Aquinas writes that this is justice in a larger sense. Larga justitia accepta. So vis-a-vis creation, it is because of this primary sense of God's justice to himself that God acts justly in a secondary way, to provide for his creatures, once created, provide for them what is due to them, given the created natures they now possess. God fulfills what he intends for them. Aquinas writes, "And so also God acts justly when he gives to each that which is due to it according to the character of its nature and condition." End of quote. And he continues, "But this debt depends upon the first, because he owes to each what is ordained to it according to the order of divine wisdom." In other words, God owed it to himself to create, without creation being necessitated. The sense of "owed it to himself" here would be the sense we have in mind in English when we say, "I owe it to myself to take a break," or "I owe it to myself to break off this conversation with my colleague." However, once the nature of the creature is created, God owes to the creature what is appropriate to nature as he created it, fulfilling in the creature the end he gave to himself in creating it according to his wisdom. So despite the fact that Aquinas began his response by straightforwardly denying the application of commutative justice to God, that is, that the act of creation consists in the ordering of the individuals in creation to one another with respect to various goods, here he attributes distributive justice to God, but only subsequent to the effect of creation in the creature. Just as an aside, and again, for those of you interested in the natural law and law, I wonder, without answering, whether the denial of commutative justice at this point, that is, that the ordering of persons one to another is due to the act of creation, that's what's denied, reflects what Aquinas will say later about the nature of the human participation in the eternal law of God, which is for us the natural law. There, in the first part of the second part of the Summa, question 93, very famous question, and article 6, even more famous article, he writes, "A rational creature falls within divine providence in a singular and particular way, insofar as it has providence over itself and other things. Hence it participates eternal reason, through which it has a natural inclination to its due act and end. And such participation of the eternal law in a rational creature is called the natural law." Notice the passage refers to the due act and end of the rational creature that pertains to it, presumably according to the rational nature it has. So the idea of what is due according to commutative justice is found in the account of the natural law. But because it is a rational creature, the ordering of what is due among rational creatures is within the dominion or providence of rational creatures over themselves. The dominion over themselves given to them by God's providence, and not specifically ordained by God's act of creation. In other words, the specific form that commutative justice takes in the ordering of a society is not divinely ordained, but is ordained by the dominion of human beings over themselves as their specific participation in the eternal law of God. It is part of the providence of God that rational creatures have providence over themselves in their ordering of one to another. As I say, this is just a speculation about what Aquinas leaves open in his discussion of creation when he does not associate commutative justice with the divine act. In the body of the question, Aquinas does not call this primary justice of God to himself in the act of creation metaphorical justice. However, he appears to be relying upon his understanding of the point Aristotle makes in the Nicomachean Ethics, Book 5, Chapter 11, that justice towards oneself is a kind of metaphorical justice by likeness, insofar as one's parts act in their due order one to another. Aristotle's discussion is, of course, reminiscent of Plato's account of justice in the tripartite soul of the Republic. Plato had argued that the soul has three parts, the rational, the spirited, and the concupiscent. Those three parts are a mirror image of the major parts of the city, the rulers, the guardians of public order and against external threat, and the producers and consumers. Justice consists in the appropriate harmony of these parts one to another. Justice in the soul is then a mirror image of justice in the city, and they are interdependent, according to Plato. There's no justice in the soul without justice in the city, and vice versa for Plato. Aristotle does not accept this thesis of the mirroring of justice in the city and justice in the soul, but he holds on to an image of it in the soul, explaining perhaps a common term of phrase amongst Athenians speaking of a well-ordered soul. And so he says it is by likeness and metaphor. Aquinas, influenced by Aristotle here, discusses this metaphorical justice towards oneself in the second part of the second part of the Summa, question 58. He explains that it ordinarily seems that justice must involve another supposit, a thing, a being, because justice imports the notion of equality, and equality is essentially a relation to another being. That is how equality differs from identity. However, one can speak of the distinction of one's parts and powers acting in relation to one another. But to speak of powers acting rather than the substance acting is to speak metaphorically. It's a form of synecdoche, whereby a term for a whole is applied to a part. Properly speaking, it is substances that act. You, the substance, act. But we often say that the eye sees, or the hand grasps, when strictly speaking, I see with my eye, and I grasp with my hand. Thus, one can speak metaphorically of the justice within oneself insofar as one's parts and powers are well ordered toward one another as distinctive principles of operation. This internal justice of the human supposite clearly harkens back to Plato's theory of the justice of a human being's parts as exhibiting a kind of harmony. The concupiscible, the irascible, and the rational, one to another. Indeed, Aquinas explicitly mentions those three parts in his discussion, although he doesn't mention Plato. It's important, however, to understand something about how Aquinas understands metaphor and how it was typically used in pre-modern times. We now use metaphor in a way that suggests it isn't literally true, presumably because it involves an image. So, I might say the Packers killed the Browns, or the Steelers. There's my modification. The Packers killed the Browns or the Steelers on the field Sunday. They killed them. You will reply, well, that's not literally true. Really? Is it false, then? Yes, it's literally false, is what you'll say. But perhaps it's spiritually true. The notion of a spiritual truth contrasted with literal truth reminds me of the scene in Bride's Head Revisited between Rex Mottram and the priest. The priest running through the catechism with Rex. The priest in that, by the way, was supposed to be patterned after Ronald Knox. Yeah, Ronald Knox, who translated the Bible just before they did the Jerusalem Bible and made his translation obsolete. The priest running through the catechism with Rex so that he can marry Julia asks, what is the doctrine of papal infallibility? Rex responds, well, Father, whatever the Pope says is true. Well, suppose the Pope says it's going to rain tomorrow. Well, then it's going to rain tomorrow. But Rex, suppose it doesn't rain tomorrow. Oh, Father, that's a hard one. Let me think for a minute. I've got it, Father. What the Pope meant is that it would rain spiritually, but we're too blinded by original sin to see it. That's what I think of when I hear someone contrast a metaphorical statement with literal truth. The effort to make something appear to be true no matter what, having first denied that it is in fact true. On the contrary, for Aquinas and many pre-moderns, the use of an image in speech did not render a literal statement false. Augustine works on this in detail in his two great commentaries on the literal sense of Genesis. Some truths about reality can only be communicated adequately with an image. Bare, ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. And on the fourth day, God created the sun and the earth. You have been raised to say, that's not literally true. St. Augustine would say, it's literally true. It tells you something about the world, the way the world is. Okay, so that's what he means by literal truth. Communicates to you the reality of the world. You'll say, well, that's not literally true because there are no days before there's a sun. Okay, so Augustine worried about what's going on there precisely because he could see. There's a problem here if you take the words in what he would call their plain sense. Not their literal sense, but their plain sense. What Aquinas, it is literally true involving a metaphor to communicate about reality that it proceeds in an orderly way according to the logos of God. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Order is what's communicated by the mention of days. Okay? It's not a scientific theory. That doesn't mean it's not literally true. What Aquinas and Augustine would say is you are confusing the plain sense of a text with its literal sense. You can say in the plain sense it is false that God created the sun on the fourth day, in its plain sense. But you cannot say it is not literally true because it uses an image. It uses an image to communicate the way the world is. Indeed, if you are a Christian, you must say it is literally true, though the truth is communicated with an image. So we need to understand this when Aquinas follows Aristotle in talking about the metaphorical justice one has towards oneself. Something important and literally true about the nature of the soul and its proper order is being communicated in and through an image. It's not a spiritual truth. It's a literal truth that would be more difficult to communicate without the image. Imagine if all you saw on Monday morning was the final score of the Bears versus the Packers. And now I'm shifting to my arch nemesis. I grew up in Green Bay, so. If it just said, 48 to 17. Of course, the 17 points was scored all in the last 2 minutes by the Bears because the Packers are saving the team for the next. It was 48 to nothing before that. And of course, you wouldn't get a sense of how the game actually went if you just reported the score by quarter, or even the statistics. The Packers killed the Bears on Sunday, destroyed them. Yeah, but they got on the bus and went home. Yes, and they killed them. Right? So it's telling you something that the image communicates about reality. Something important and literally true about the nature of the soul and its proper order is being communicated in and through an image. A literal truth that would be more difficult to communicate without the image. Thus, even though God, who is simple, does not have parts, but having established that justice can be applied metaphorically as pertaining to a substance in relation to itself, the connection of metaphorical justice of God, both to himself and to the effect of creation, is made clear in response to the third objection of question 58. There, Aquinas writes, the justice of God is from eternity, according to eternal will and purpose. And justice consists chiefly in this. However, it is not eternal as regards the effect, because nothing is co-eternal with God. In this passage, Aquinas argues that because of the difference between the eternity of divine justice and lack of eternity in creation, divine justice is related to the order of God's will and eternal purpose, not to its effect in creation. The point he had made much earlier in question 21 of the first part, here what is playing the metaphorical role of parts, ordered one to another, are God's will, wisdom, and goodness. Those are the parts. Again, despite the fact that in reality there is no distinction in God between such parts. It's an image. The distinction is in the way we speak, communicating something to us about reality that we could not get without the image. It is important not to misunderstand Aquinas' appeal to metaphorical justice. Earlier, Aquinas had asked whether it is appropriate for sacred doctrine to use metaphor to speak of divine things, insofar as metaphor appeals to images, and in that respect is akin to poetry. His response that while poetry employs images in order to please, sacred doctrine employs them from necessity to communicate truth concerning divine matters in the least misleading way. So he's saying that the metaphor is the least misleading thing you would say. If you tried to say it in the plain sense of words, that would be more misleading. The image and the metaphor is less misleading about God. Following Aristotle, Aquinas had raised the issue of the metaphorical justice of a human being to himself or herself in a way that is not tied to the necessity of sacra doctrina. The qualification he makes that, strictly speaking, the parts and powers of a substance do not act, but rather the substance acts in virtue of its powers, parts and powers, is a point that Aquinas regularly makes about human action, and it is entirely general. As seen in Aristotle's application of the justice of an individual to himself or herself, the metaphor occurs in a strictly philosophical context, the Nicomachean Ethics. So he's not making it up to talk about God. That is the way that Aquinas uses the point of the body of the article, discussing whether one can be just toward oneself. It's a way of speaking that we engage in, employing a metaphor, a way of speaking that is not in fact necessary in the human case, although there is no error in doing so. With the metaphor, we assert that the parts and powers of the agent are well ordered toward one another in the act of the agent, who is strictly speaking the one who acts, not his or her parts. However, with the extension to God, Aquinas' position in general is that metaphorical terms, as opposed to univocal or even analogical terms, are necessary because they are the best instruments of language in which to assert literal truths about the divine. That the effect of creation, the existence of creatures, is metaphorical justice rather than distributive justice, thus marks a real distinction among all God's effects. It marks the distinction between creation as such that initiates the manifestation of God's will and wisdom, and those effects that subsequently fulfill the manifestation of God's will and wisdom. In the human case, the truth can be communicated without the metaphor, although it is useful to employ the metaphor. However, in the divine case, the metaphor cannot be paraphrased away. It is rather necessary to say something true about God that could not otherwise be said in ordinary non-metaphorical language. So when you think of scripture, when you think of sacra doctrina, what you need to understand is that Thomas thinks the metaphors of that tell you something about reality and God, and they can't be eliminated. I often say to my students when talking about this in a class I have called Aquinas on God, you are some sort of, philosophy student. How many in here are philosophy students? Oh, good. You're lovers of wisdom. And you die, sorry, and you go to heaven because you've lived a good life, and St. Peter says to you, I've got one question for you. Is God a rock? And you say, not literally. That's literally false, St. Peter. And St. Peter says, go to hell. And you say, no, I'm sorry. It's true. Okay, you can come in. We wouldn't have sent you to hell anyway. It was a joke. And then you meet God. And God says, so, what do you think? Am I a rock? Well, let me explain to you what that means. It means that you have a kind of stability in your will and your wisdom and you're steadfast. Think of the word steadfast. You stand fast. That's an image. So another thing I tell my students is try to go a day talking about reality without using a metaphor. They never come back the next day and say, I did it. But try it. Speak without a metaphor the entire day when you intend to say something about the way the world is, however mundane. So anyway, God listens to you giving your philosophical account of what it means in Scripture to say God is a rock. And God says, get used to it. I'm a rock. And that's the best you're going to get. That's what I'd say to you to help you understand. Now, a little shift into these, the question of justice and forgiveness, which is the framework I want to try to play with tomorrow. Justice and three forms of forgiveness. Forgiveness as temperance. I want to turn now to three different notions of forgiveness we can discern in Aquinas and their relation to justice. I noted above that questions of the justice of punishment pertain to commutative justice. And so, strictly speaking, they do not pertain to the justice of creation, not even the subsequent distributive justice that Aquinas does think pertains to God's act of creation. However, after discussing the mercy of creation tomorrow, I want to suggest how the mercy of creation may set a framework for understanding God's forgiveness. So there are three notions of forgiveness to be found in Aquinas, at least three, relevant to this retreat. Forgiveness as temperance, forgiveness as sovereign judicial forgiveness, and the mercy of forgiveness. The first notion of forgiveness, forgiveness as temperance, is to be found in Aquinas' discussion of the virtue of clemencia, clemency, in the second part of the second part of the Summa. The background for his discussion is Roman, as seen in the great Stoics Cicero and Seneca, but especially Seneca. Seneca, in a letter to Nero, praises clemency in the great souled ruler. De clemencia is Seneca's effort to encourage Nero to temper the punishment he metes out to his subjects, if he would be a virtuous ruler. Stoic clemency does not challenge the justice of punishments, but tempers them. It involves good judgment among a range of punishment that fits an offense, punishing less than may be allowed by justice, but still punishing justly. It is not a decision made subsequent to the judgment of punishment, but informs it before it is imposed. Seneca encourages in Nero temperance of soul in reigning in the ferocity of anger, or of angry vengeance and cruelty. The setting is one of political sovereignty and justice, and the appeal is to the ruler's sense of the superiority or greatness of his own soul, which is more manifest in the temperance of forgiveness than in punishing to the greatest extent that justice will allow. To avoid cruelty, the great ruler stops short of everything he might do in punishing, prompted by a cruel harshness of his own mind. Clemency is concerned with temperance of mind in exacting punishment, Seneca says. Virtue, which is the divine likeness within the ruler, is found in the temperate forgiveness of a powerful ruler. How many of you have seen the film Schindler's List? There's a scene in there where Schindler is talking to the commandant after they've had dinner and they're drunk, especially Eamon Guth, who was the commandant. And Schindler tries to convince him not to be so cruel, not to shoot the Jews as they walk by for fun, not to be as awful as he is. And he it's a Stoic appeal. It's basically Seneca talking to Nero. And for a while, and he says, look, your power is really exhibited in what you don't do to them rather than in what you do to them. And so Guth tries for about 3 days, and he kind of like, as Jews walk by, he says, I pardon you. But because he's vicious, he can only do it for about 3 days, and after about 3 days, he starts shooting them arbitrarily again, right? But that's what Seneca is talking about, is a kind of virtue of self-control, okay, on the part of the one who holds power. This forgiveness does not have as its object the good of the one forgiven, despite the fact that for a Stoic, a clement ruler is the best ruler. The one forgiven will indeed benefit, but that's not the object of the forgiveness. The object of this forgiveness is the temperance of the ruler with regard to inflicting punishment driven by vengeance. It manifests the greatness of soul of the one who forgives. So its object is the promotion of the individual good of the one who forgives. In this context, the primary virtue in play concerning punishment is justice. So any forgiveness extended should not violate the demands of justice. But it is important that because forgiveness as clemency is concerned with the sovereign's own good, his strength of soul, it is not concerned with either the common good or the good of the one being punished, even if it and he happen to benefit indirectly. When Aquinas discusses clemencia as a virtue, he acknowledges and accepts the fundamental structure of clemencia as a Stoic virtue, and classes it as a virtue under the cardinal virtue of temperance. Seneca had claimed that the true clemency of a ruler displays genuine love of humanity because it dulls the blade of sovereign power, a kind of abstract love for what is best for all, humanity. Aquinas, however, differs from this abstract love in arguing that clemencia is prompted by love of the offender himself. Motivated by love, one does not take pleasure in punishment itself, but only to the extent that it serves something else like justice or the correction of the wrongdoer. So prompted by love, one seeks to mitigate the punishment that is being exacted upon another for some wrong. Where the Stoic is not prompted by love of the offender, but the greatness of his own soul. However, even though it is motivated by love, love of the offender is not its object, not what it benefits, according to Aquinas. Throughout, Thomas discusses clemency in conjunction with meekness. Both virtues bear upon anger and the passion for vengeance in the face of an offense. Like the Stoic virtue, clemency's object concerns establishing a virtue that bears upon the good of the individual who is driven to punish by vengeance. Meekness tempers the internal concupiscent passion for vengeance itself, where clemency tempers the act of punishment that is motivated by that passion. Neither virtue bears directly upon the good of the one being punished, which is why for Aquinas they are both classed under temperance and not justice. So even though motivated by love of neighbor, clemency does not directly bear upon the good of another itself. In this, Aquinas agrees with the Stoics. The one forgiven by clemencia may benefit, but only incidentally, to the object of the virtue that directly benefits the one who extends clemency. It is justice that, properly speaking, bears upon the good of others. All right, judicial and sovereign forgiveness of a punishment. Now consider a rather different notion of forgiveness that is to be found in Aquinas' discussion of judicial forgiveness. The dominant Latin term in this context is remittere, from which we get the English term to remit. This judicial forgiveness is related to the discussion of clemencia in that it concerns law and justice. However, this judicial forgiveness is different from clemency for at least two reasons. First, in the discussion of clemencia, Aquinas himself never uses the term remittere or any of its cognate terms. It shows up in that context only once, and that in a quotation of classical Latin from Seneca. On the other hand, in the discussion of judicial relaxation of punishment, Aquinas nowhere speaks of clemency, but rather remittere, as the term used for the relaxation of punishment. In the second place, while clemency was a virtue classed under temperance, not justice, the question under consideration is a kind of odd one when you come across it. Concerning the injustice of a judge in judging, Aquinas argues that remission of punishment by a judge is classed among the vices opposed to justice. The remission of punishment by a judge is classed among the vices opposed to justice. Forgiveness of punishment given by an ordinary judge is a vice opposed to commutative justice. The role of the judge is to make a judgment applying the law with respect to the particular under consideration vis-a-vis guilt or innocence, and then to apply the punishment set by the law. The judge is bound by the law. The judge serves the sovereign and the sovereign's law and has no discretion whatsoever in relaxing the punishment required by the law. From this point, it follows immediately that clemencia, has no place in the activity of an ordinary judge, since any clemency exercised by him or her for his or her own good would violate justice. And according to Aquinas, clemency cannot violate justice. Aquinas does think, however, that there is a place for the remission of punishment that may be just. Remission of punishment belongs to the sovereign as part of his plenipotentiary power, acting for the common good, and then it can be just. It's a vice in a judge to remit punishment, but not in the sovereign. It should be said that obviously our system of punishment in relation to the role, of judges differs. We do grant judges in many instances the authority to remit punishment. However, that is only as a ministerial power, of the sovereign community delegated to judges. So it is a small difference, and Aquinas's point remains. There are at least two important points about the character of remission of punishment by the sovereign. First, while clemency was classed under the cardinal virtue of temperance, having as its object the good of the individual subject to the passion of vengeance, sovereign forgiveness is tacitly classed under the cardinal virtue of justice. For its object is not the individual good of the sovereign, but of the common good of the political community. Sovereign forgiveness has as its object the good of another, the polity, the common good, and so pertains to justice. It's a matter of commutative justice. Second, sovereign forgiveness is limited in two ways, one of which is very striking. The first limit is expected. The sovereign cannot extend forgiveness to a malefactor inordinately, that is, unjustly in a way that harms the common good. The sovereign is bound by the justice that bears upon the common good. But the striking limitation is that not even the sovereign can forgive the punishment due a malefactor if the one harmed by the original offense does not consent to the forgiveness. While the sovereign as such looks to the common good and the justice appropriate to it, he is limited by justice concerning the individual. For Aquinas explains that to forgive the malefactor without the consent of the one harmed would be to act unjustly toward the one harmed and presumably compound the original injustice done to him. Notice the point is not that this forgiveness is an act of the individual as well as the sovereign. No, it's an act of political sovereignty, but it requires the consent of the offended. Aquinas exempts God's forgiveness of sin from this limitation, since ultimately sin is an offense against him. But God does not remit punishment, quote, except insofar as it accords with his goodness, which is the source of all laws. Well, I've stressed that this is a different sense of forgiveness from clemency because it looks to the good of another. The other here is the political community. And the limitation upon sovereign forgiveness by justice to the individual looks to the good of the individual offended. But like clemency, no mention in sovereign forgiveness is made of the good of the one being punished. Punishment can, it seems, be for the good of the one punished insofar as it corrects him or her. We saw Aquinas acknowledge that fact as the reason why one might punish another, despite one's aversion through love to see someone punished. But with regard to the relaxation of punishment, the good of the one being punished seems not to be the point of either clemencia or sovereign judicial forgiveness. The third form of forgiveness that I want to mention occurs in Aquinas' discussion of the atonement and our justification by Christ. It is distinguished in part by the fact that it is directed precisely at the good of the one or ones who are subject to punishment. For Aquinas, the atonement involves at least two aspects on our part, that we are justified and that satisfaction is made for the debt of punishment due to sin. First, justification reflects the name. We are made right with respect to the order of justice. Where original sin rendered us alienated from original justice and the order of charity. Which alienation is fundamentally alienation from God, who has originated that order of justice and charity for us in creation. This is the distributive order of justice, Aquinas says, follows creation, not God's justice to himself. Sin, original and actual, results in a twofold bondage, to the sin itself and to the punishment due according to the order of justice. To be made right, the sin must be remitted. But the remission of sin is not enough, because according to the order of divine justice, we remain in the debt of punishment. Satisfaction for that debt of punishment must be made to God's justice. It is Christ who, by the grace of his incarnation and the merits of his sacrificial death, both justifies us by the remission of sin and satisfies the debt by the remission of punishment. So this forgiveness is a twofold remission, directed upon the offense and directed upon the punishment that is due for it. What is striking about justification and satisfaction is how the forgiveness of punishment specifically plays a role within it. In both clemency and sovereign forgiveness, the forgiveness of punishment that is due is lessened. In both clemency and sovereign forgiveness, the forgiveness of punishment that is due is lessened. It is relaxed in the sense of being reduced and perhaps brought to nothing. But when Aquinas talks about the forgiveness of punishment in the context of the atonement, he does not speak of it as a relaxing of punishment in the sense of reduction. For the saved, in the case of mortal sin, the debt of punishment remains just as it is. It is not reduced. But the sacrificial effect of Christ's death is that the eternal punishment due to sin is indeed forgiven the sinner, but it is forgiven because it is fully paid by Christ in an act of substitution. So the punishment is not lessened, it's completely paid. This is relaxation as substitution rather than as reduction. So here the forgiveness of punishment, remittere pena, has a quite different character than it has in either clemency or sovereign forgiveness. And in particular, it should not be thought of as divine sovereign forgiveness. Grave sin is the disorientation or being at odds with or alienated from God. It is, quote, living in sin. As Julia Marchmain puts it in Brideheads Revisited, if you haven't read that book, by now I hope you think, I should read that book. It has two aspects, the turning from God, which is due the punishment of eternal damnation, and the turning as well to some worldly good, which is due temporal punishment. The sinful act cannot be undone as a matter of historical necessity, not even by God, but its effect in our alienation from God, our living in sin, can be undone. So the sin is forgiven in that sense, and at the same time, the debt of eternal punishment is paid by the infinite merits of Christ's sacrifice, paid in full. Because the debt is fully paid by Christ, the order of justice is completely and perfectly fulfilled by divine mercy. In fact, because Aquinas thinks the incarnation as a response to original sin, you think of the Easter Vigil, O felix culpa, O happy fault by which so great a thing came into the world, makes available to humanity a greater participation in beatitude than was available before sin. It's not just restoration, but it's elevation. Divine mercy superabounds justice, Thomas says. It doesn't limit justice. It doesn't pull justice back. It superabounds it. It goes beyond justice. Not pulling justice back, but going beyond justice. Divine mercy superabounds justice. I love that phrase. Like the man who owes 100 coins but pays 200 instead. That's Thomas's analogy. You owe a debt of 100. I give the person you owe the debt to 200. You can't say that's unjust just because I paid for you. The person you owed it to has twice what you owed him. It superabounds justice. It goes beyond justice rather than asks for justice to be relaxed. The atonement, justification, and satisfaction are not associated with a sovereign judicial act of God. Instead, Aquinas associates it through the incarnation with an act of divine friendship for human beings. And yet there is justice among friends. And so justice continues to play a role. So we have here a third sense of forgiveness, but a sense quite different from either temperate clemency or sovereign forgiveness. It is the forgiveness of a friend that reestablishes the concord among those who have offended and those who have been offended. But it is more than the simple restoration of the order among friends. It goes further to offering a gift on behalf of one's friend to assist in paying the debt of justice due to the offense one's friend has committed against one. Let us pause for a moment on this thought. If we forgive our friends in the sense of not requiring just restitution for the offense, If we simply reduce the debt by forgetting it, then it is possible the attitude we implicitly take toward our friend is the attitude of a sovereign over his or her subjects, as if being offended by another makes one superior to that other. But the sense of forgiveness among friends that Aquinas is giving here in the atonement is something other than sovereign forgiveness. It's not one in which the offense has made one superior to the offender. In the case of sin, it is simply absurd to think that our sin against God is an offense that makes God superior to us, prompting sovereign forgiveness of us. God could, if he chose, forgive us as a sovereign. But according to the atonement specifically, he does not. Instead, he forgives us as a friend.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.